page 319. Knut Hamsun by Leo Löwenthal. Less concerned than Adorno with formal issues of content, Löwenthal's essay, originally published in Zeitschrift für Sozialforschung, volume Roman 6, 1937, is a splendid example of ideology critique applied to a sphere allegedly free from ideology. While the longing and glorification of nature is rooted in a correct response to the experience of alienation and domination in bourgeois society, the escape to a sphere or vision abstractly opposed to it merely reinforces what it seeks to avoid. That ideology hides precisely where it is least suspected was a favorite argument of the members of the Institute. Löwenthal's argument embodies a typical figure of thought. An abstract, absolute opposition does not really contradict its opposite at all. Instead, it becomes the other side of the same coin, rejecting a life of isolation and domination. Hamsun's characters countered it with an isolated alternative whose merely reactive meaning now equally dominates them. Like their audience, they thus remain within the very mode of experience they tried to overcome. In the periods studied so far, literary artists expressed through their characters the conviction that the activities of the individual are rooted in universally binding values and that, therefore, these fictional life histories could serve as a parable or a stimulus to others. By the end of the 19th century, however, the artist ceases to reflect this ideal of the ethical unity of men. Page 320. At this best, the modern writer, like all writers, keep alive the hopes of the individual and the ideal of his self-realization in society. Even the defeats he portrays are meaningful within this context. At his worst, however, he can fall victim to an irrational escape into the arms of authoritarianism. Knud Hamsun was this kind of writer. In the 20s and 30s, his work not only enjoyed an excellent international literary reputation, but also was regarded even by liberals and socialists as politically above reproach. However, in his act of joining Quisling's party during the Second World War, he expressed in practice the authoritarian themes and moods that had long been implicit in his novels. The pagan awe of unlimited and unintelligible forces of nature, the mystique of blood and race, hatred of the working class and the clerics, the blind submission to authority, the abrogation of individual responsibility, anti-intellectualism, and spiteful distrust of urban middle-class life in general. Footnote 1, text. Nature. In Ibsen, the hymn to nature as a last gesture of hope comes at the end of his final play, When We Dead Awaken. Man has found in the social realm not true freedom but only a mirage. By contrast with its pressure and restrictions, nature appears as a realm of freedom and a source of happiness and consultation. In enjoyment of the countryside, nothing seems to remain of the perpetual toil and responsibility, competition and even hostility. Communion with nature holds out a new image of man, one that will counter the image of himself as a victim. The meaning of nature in almost every age is inseparable from social considerations. In the Renaissance, nature meant at once a scene of man's activities, a field for conquest and an inspiration. It formed the mise-en-scene of men's life. To be sure, even then there was an element of protest. The ideals of natural life in the works of Cervantes and Shakespeare implied a rejection of the contemporary unnatural society. Nevertheless, the concept of nature as a counter-ideal to society strengthened the optimistic belief in progress, since it provided men with a yardstick against which shortcomings could be more clearly seen and evaluated. In the history of Western European drama, from Shakespeare to Ibsen, and of poetry from Petrarch to Hölderlin, the path to nature was not a flight but a stroll toward liberation. Page 321. However, with the coming of doubt and even despair about personal fulfillment within society, the image of nature was no longer a basis for a new perspective, but became an alternative. Nature was increasingly envisaged as the ultimate surcease of social pressure. In this context, men submit to nature and feel at peace, at least in fantasy. His soul, inviolably in ideology yet outraged in reality, could find solace in such a submission, frustrated in his attempt to participate autonomously in the societal work. He could join the world of nature. He could become a thing like the tree or the brook and find more pleasure in his surrender than in a hopeless struggle against man-made forces. This is the most significant change in man's imagery of his environment to take place in the closing decades of the 19th century in Europe. The novels of Knut Hamsun's portray this antinomy of society and nature in an extreme form. Sentimentalism and brutality. The image of nature in Hamsun's novels has little in common with earlier conceptions of nature as a source of directives for human conduct. It lacks the critical element that made Rousseau's naturalism, for example, a progressive political and cultural force in the 18th century. Since the Renaissance, man had seen himself able, at least potentially, to conquer some of nature's forces. This attitude reflected his faith in the unlimited potential of reason and, specifically, his hope for political and social reconstruction. In Hamsun, submission to nature functions as an escape from the burden of social responsibility. This passive attitude in part explains why Hamsun's heroes are able to profess sentimental pity for the unsheltered animal, the tree in the wind, or the withering foliage. In the fate of nature's children, they see a reflection of their own helplessness. To be a victim in the world of men is a threat to dignity. There is a certain solace, in the other hand, in being a victim of majestic natural forces for which men cannot be expected to be personally accountable. Paradoxically, this new type of submission to nature is closely related to political submission. The yearning for surrender to nature, as it appears in Hamsun's novels, not only glorifies the awareness of individual weakness, but at the same time exalts reverence for superior power in general. In our time, we have seen in Europe's totalitarian movements the apotheosis of unshakable political authority, unshakable in part because one cannot fathom it. The timelessness and magnificence of nature reinforces the finality of the political power under which man lives. Page 322. The yearning at once for stability and for glory is a trait of fascist ideology. Hitler's Thousand Years of History that appears alongside this new type of nature worship. The home in the Victorian period particularly was a refuge from the harshness of business and professional life. In Ibsen, We saw the idyll of the home devoured by the monster of competition, and nature, flight to nature as protest becomes flight to nature as idolatry, and communion with nature is transformed from sentiment to sentimentality and then into brutality. Implicit in this change is an element of anti-intellectualism. The use of reason in whatever form is indissolubly bound up with the responsibility of the thinker. Thus, the flight to nature for the sake of abdication of human responsibility soon comes to be rationalized in thought that a horse thinking. This anti-intellectualism must be distinguished from vitalist and pragmatist philosophies earlier in this century. Bergson, Dilthey, and certain American philosophers rebelled against rationalist rigidity, to be sure, but their works were nonetheless responsible theoretical enterprises oriented toward the goal of higher individual development. Vitalism, Lebensphilosophie, as it was taken up by the ideological spokesman of fascism, looked rather to the submergence of the individual. Reason was rejected in favor of overpowering mythical forces, blood and race. This submergence of reason accompanied a glorification of the peasant, an integral part of anti-liberal undercurrents. The peasant is seen as not alienated from his work, unlike the industrial worker. He does not seem to violate nature, but follows, so to speak, its true rhythm. Since his work is hard, healthy, meaningful, and in harmony with natural processes, it is set forth as the model of true manliness, dignified and silent. In the analysis that follows, an effort will be made to show that the sentimental conceptions of nature and peasants in Hamsun's novels anticipate an intrinsic part of those political ideologies that forge the concept of leader, social coercion, and soil into a tool of brutality. Flight into nature. At first sight, Hamsun does not seem qualified to represent the emergence of a typically modern European authoritarian ethos. It is noteworthy, however, that it was in Germany that Hamsun obtained his greatest response from the very beginning, coming from a small country that, unlike the larger nations, has primary economic interests in agriculture and fishing. Hamsun might be expected to portray themes different from those of writers in highly industrialized nations.
Page 323.
But in fact, it is just this disparity between Norwegian conditions and the situation of the larger and industrially more advanced countries that makes Hamsun's picture of his society so reassuring at first glance and so foreboding upon closer analysis. Footnote 2, text. Hamsun's first novel, Hunger, written in autobiographical form and published in 1890, states the themes that are almost endlessly repeated in the later novels. Abandonment of any participation in public life, submission to the stream of incomprehensible and incalculable forces, distrust of the intellect, flight from the city and escape to nature. The opening sentence of Hunger evokes the fate of the average city dweller. It was during the time I wandered about and starved in Christiania. Christiania, this singular city from which no man departs without carrying away the traces of his sojourn there. Footnote 3, text. The theme of the city is set at once. The fate of the hero is not comprehensible in terms of any conditions specific to him. He is, in this case, luckless and starving, but only in terms of the most general fact in the city. When he has finally had his fill and leaves as a newly hired sailor, the novel ends on the same note with which it began. Out in the fjord, I dragged myself up once, wet with fever and exhaustion, and gazed landwards, and bade farewell for the present to the town, to Christiana, where the windows gleamed so brightly in all the homes. Footnote 4, text. One of Hampson's figures once replied to an apologist for the city.